Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're talking about the local and independent film scene, its history, and its future. Tim Williams has been a producer and media consultant all along the West Coast, and since 2014, he's been executive director of the Governor's Office of Film and Television, better known as Oregon Film. Mac Burns is the executive director of the Clatsop County Historical Society. He's been instrumental in the establishment of the Oregon Film Museum in Astoria and also has had a hand in building the Oregon Film Trail. Ryan Graves is a filmmaker and the business relationship manager at Proludio, a developer of theatrical playback systems for cinemas that can't afford the high-end digital projection equipment. Tim, Mac, and Ryan, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Thanks, Coach.
Thanks.
Tim, I've heard you called the backbone of the media industry in Oregon. Tell us, what sort of magic have you been wielding in the state lately?
I would never call it the backbone of anything, nor have I any magic whatsoever, but I appreciate the kind words. Not sure they're deserved. Like everybody, and I'm sure Mac and Ryan can attest to this, it's been a very, very unprecedented and weird year on so many levels. And so, oddly enough, we were busier during the pandemic than we are after the pandemic. Now, that's just because of timing more than anything. But starting in July of last year, we sort of geared up really fast with a lot of protocols with things like Chad and Top Chef and The Birch and Shrill. A Netflix movie was here. And, you know, so things are sort of happening. What happened, though, during the pandemic over the last year or so, and something that has been sort of the bread and butter of Oregon's film industry, is the independent, the medium-sized and the lower-sized features and TV series couldn't work because the health and safety protocols were so expensive. And so what we saw was a lot of the larger scale productions that could actually afford those health and safety protocols begin to work during the pandemic where the smaller features didn't. We are now seeing those smaller features starting to come back, short films, independent features, all that kind of stuff are starting to come back now that vaccinations are more prominent and things are starting to loosen up a little. So I'm kind of cautiously optimistic, but we've always had such a great balanced system where we have larger productions that come in and sell the state and an international audience. And then we also have the smaller locally produced productions that are always going on in various parts of the state. And we're starting to see that finally come back into fruition.
Now, we were talking recently with Ali Rushfield and David Kress about Shrill. And Shrill, I guess that's sort of a medium-sized production. I think it took advantage of the fact that Oregon did fairly well during the COVID pandemic, and they were able to open up, but, you know, not exactly when they wanted to. They usually film in the summer. They had to thread the needle and get things going in the fall.
That's right. They absolutely wanted to go in the summer, and they actually delayed a little bit, and they pulled 80 out of Saturday Night Live in order to do that. But they got it done, and they got it done when they needed to, which is great. Very sad to see that it's not coming back for a season four. I think it deserved a season four, but we were really happy to have them here for season three. And to your point, you know, we actually do really well in those sort of medium-sized TV series. You know, Trinkets, Shrill, Portlandia, Librarians, they're all not massive productions, but they certainly are big enough for us. And they also bring a huge amount of notoriety to the state, something that, you know, we try very much to make sure gets sort of recognized by the Film Museum, which also drives a lot of the back end, because I think tourism on these things are so wonderful. Oregon is unique in that almost everything that shoots here is shooting Oregon for Oregon. You know, we're not doubling other places. And I think that's not the case up in BC and in Vancouver. And it's definitely not the case in sort of places like Georgia and California. So we do have a long, long history of production work celebrating Oregon, but also a creative community that actually is very invested in it. And that goes back, as Mac can tell you, that goes back to 1908. Am I right there, Mac? Or is it 1909?
1909.
Sorry about that.
We learned the correct date about 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
I always used to say
1908.
Well, Mac, you are out in Astoria there. You have the Oregon Film Museum, which is, it's heavily geared towards The Goonies, which was filmed in Astoria. You're one of the organizations that has really been trying to recognize that it's not just Hollywood that's been bringing entertainment to the nation's cinemas and to the world's cinemas.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, obviously we know Goonies is the bread and butter and what caused us to create this museum. We'd seen these celebrations and fans from all over the world come to make their Goonies pilgrimage here. But there's a rich history of filmmaking and creative people in Oregon working here all the way back to 1909 with The Fisherman's Bride. It was a Selig Polyscope Company film. And of course, Selig's the guy that created Hollywood. So 1909, before there was a Hollywood, Oregon's making movies. And that rich history, you know, people want to know where their favorite movie or television show was filmed. They want to go see that site if it's real. And that's one of the reasons that Tim and the Oregon Film Commission has created this film trail. And that's part of our goal is we'd love everybody to come to Astoria, but we also want to drive them all around the state. And if you're a chamber of commerce or if you're another local museum somewhere, that this pie is awfully big of people wanting to track down that production that they loved as a kid or that spoke to them at some point in their lives. And our sites are all still out there. And Oregon's a big old place with over 400, 500 major film and television productions that you can go and explore and see the real places.
All right. You mentioned the Oregon Film Trail. For the folks who haven't heard of that yet, that has been really ramping up in recent years. Tell us about how the Oregon Film Trail can be accessed.
That's OregonFilmTrail.com, actually. Very simple and easy to remember. There wouldn't be a film trail without Max's efforts in the film museum. Is I think what was very obvious from the film museum up in Astoria is that people wanted somewhere to go to access these things. And so the film trail was born off the back of that. And so recognizing Goonies, Stand By Me, One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, Homeward Bound, even Phoenix, Oregon, which is something Ryan helped out with last summer, actually making it number one at the box office, which was sort of right. A huge, huge deal for us. We just put up a sign down at Klamath Falls where that shot. And so there is this, what I love about Oregon, as opposed to many other states, is there's this cohesiveness of the industry, of how people are making these things. There's a history, there's a culture to it. And then there's also tourism that drives all across the state. And everybody is sort of a part of it in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's one of the unique aspects of Oregon in particular.
Well, Ryan, we mentioned Phoenix, Oregon. I had a number of the folks on the show a couple of years ago, Molly Kreutzmann among them, who were involved in Phoenix, Oregon. That was a surprise runaway hit filmed in Klamath Falls. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it was pretty exciting to see because it's you know, I get a lot of independent filmmakers come to us because what we have here is this Prolidio is a service and it's a hardware where we send the hardware out to these independent movie theaters and then we digitally deliver the film file to those theaters and then they play back the film file. It's similar to what, you know, the Regals and the AMCs do, but we do it like the indie way where we're not charging an arm and leg because we're not Hollywood, we're indie filmmakers ourselves. And so I have a lot of indie filmmakers come to us and be like, "Hey, can we put this film on here?" And you know, mind you, we're providing all the biggest indie films that are out there, everything from A24, Roadside Attractions, IFC Films, Sony Pictures Classics. So like all the biggest indie films are available on our platform. But then when I get independent filmmakers for like Phoenix, Oregon, it's like, you know, for me, I was like, I don't know if this is going to do anything. I'm really glad that it exists and it got made in Oregon. So I'm happy to help push it out there. But, you know, it turned into this the most successful film last year, basically. And I think part of it was just, you know, part of what I do is just letting all my clients, because I have, you know, over 50 to 60, no, more like 60 to 70 theaters using our technology. And I'm telling them, you know, play this film from A24, you know, play French Exit, play The Green Knight, and oh, play Phoenix, Oregon. And just to put Oregon films alongside, you know, these big Sundance films, these big indie films, and say, you know, play Phoenix, Oregon too. And, you know, I think that helps really get the word out and get everyone thinking about it.
I do want to ask you more about Prolidio and the technology there. But first, there's a fun bit of trivia in that there was 1 week, and it was right around the beginning of the COVID quarantine when Phoenix, Oregon was the top box office film in the country?
I think it was number one. It was number one.
It was, yes. We had two that summer. We had Phoenix, Oregon at the very beginning, thanks to Ryan's company that actually gave them the technology to do that. But then we also had the rental later that summer that was at number one for a week or so as well. Right. So we dominated the pandemic summer box office.
Okay, how did that happen exactly? Let's. I'm just curious here. It was kind of a fluke almost, but it was a good fluke.
Yeah, Ryan, I think you may know more about it than I do. I've heard both Gary and Annie talk about it, but I know it was a little bit of a timing fluke in that you were able, or the film was able to report box office in this way prior to anybody else being able to do it. So it shot to the top because it was one of the only ones that was reporting everything. Is that sound about right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of things are happening. I'm like looking at their numbers again and, you know, there was nothing coming out. You know, they were doing like the studios were bringing out their repertory films, but the repertory films would come out and would be in like 100 theaters across the country and then 10 people would go. And so, you know, you can either look at a gross from a film being like it's full gross, or you can look at its average gross. And indie films, the theater average gross is always better. Because it's always better attended. You know, when you go and see like Wrath of Man, there's like five people in the theater. But when you see, you know, French Exit, there's like 15 people in the theater. You know, non-pandemic, it'd be more than that, but, you know, limitations as they are. And I think Phoenix, Oregon just had the right, you know, indie cred, just looking like a film that had some quirk and wasn't, you know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which I've seen 100 times. I don't need to go see that again. I'd like to see something new. So I think Phoenix, Oregon for a few weeks was the only new film you could play in the first place. So they got in right at the right time. It didn't, you know, it's not like their grosses was competing with Star Wars, but it did what it had to do.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. And we're talking today about local and independent film, its history and future. Our guests are Tim Williams from Oregon Film, Ryan Graves with Proludio, and Mac Burns with the Oregon Film Museum. So Ryan, a few years ago, a bunch of Hollywood studios decided to just get rid of analog film. They had the go digital or go dark situation where the big theater chains, the big cinema chains, could afford to put in the DCP, the digital cinema package equipment, all of the digital projection equipment. And, you know, it's obviously easier to project something that can come over the internet than something that arrives in big chunky film boxes.
Yeah.
And there were these grants that went out to a whole bunch of independent cinemas, and only a few of them got the grants, and it was great for those who did. But you stepped in for the theaters that didn't get the grants and couldn't afford the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to upgrade.
Right. It's absurd what, you know, it was the studios that came together and said, hey, we as the industry want to go all digital, because, you know, in the early aughts when, you know, analog film being distributed was probably at its like highest distribution before digital cinema started. You know, you got to make, you know, thousands of prints, which is so expensive. And then you got to ship those around. And the industry is like, we can't, you know, like just that alone, that's why it's called P&A, you know, your prints and advertising. That's why it's so expensive for a film's budget. And they're like, we got to find a cheaper way and we can do it digitally. The problem is they did it on studio level. So if you're Regal, if you're AMC, you can afford, you know, ponying up and getting the equipment to play along. But if you're a mom and pa theater and you've got 50 seats in your cinema and that's it, you don't have the cash flow to pay for upgrading your projector, your sound system, and your server to do all that. And, you know, what happened was, you know, Proludio is part of the Living Room Theaters Corporation. Living Room Theaters opened in Portland over 10 years ago. And at that time, physically, we couldn't put a DCP, you know, equipment in our theater. So we had to come up with something on our own. And so we invented Proludio. So we went to the indie distributors, you know, we went to IFC, who's, you know, putting out Cave of Forgotten Dreams from Werner Herzog at that time. They're like, hey, you know, what can you do? Do you have to do this on DCP, or can we work with you? Can we find an alternative? And just starting with that relationship and then going to other distributors and saying, you know, maybe there's another way where we don't have to do this really expensive thing. We can do a format that is the same, pretty much the same quality as DCP, and it can be just as secure. So there doesn't have to be worries of piracy. and we can get it distributed. And we got it when Cave of Forgotten Dreams opened in Portland. It was huge. It was,
well, that was the Herzog documentary that was in 3D. So yeah, obviously you had to come up with some technology that would cover the same effects.
Yeah. I might be misspoken. We might've had some alternative form for that, but we were playing plenty of other films that were on Preludio, and for the longest time, all the films, you know, had to play out that way. And so we took that technology, went to all the other indie theaters out there and say, hey, we've got something. You don't have to spend $50,000 on a new projector or $50,000 on a new sound system. You can just get a really good projector and a really good sound system that is the same quality. You're just not paying for the security aspect. And, you know, now we have a footprint of about 50, 60 theaters. Obviously, the pandemic has put a hamper on all of them, and they're all trying their best to reopen. And we're in a really weird space right this second. But, you know, hopefully we'll see a new normal in the coming months.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. You have all these clients, all of these cinemas who have been closed for over a year. And they are, like you said, mom and pop operations. I suppose there wasn't government money to go around for everybody, but how has it been looking? Have people just been clinging on? Have you lost a lot of clients?
We've had pretty good retention so far. A lot of them, you know, it was funny. The first month, they're like, we're going to keep our staff on. We'll think we'll be back in a few weeks. And then as things went on, they're like, okay, maybe we need to like hibernate for a little bit longer. And so I think looking at our theaters now, about 50% of them have gotten back to operations, and the other 50% are still kind of hiding out and waiting for things to happen. I was just talking to a theater right now. Her max capacity, the number of seats in her cinema, is 26. And so the only way to do that is to go all in. And she's in Pennsylvania, and half of her attendees are totally okay with maskless no matter what. Half of them want vaccinated or nothing. And it's just, that's the other thing. It's just kind of like, what's the best way, the safest way? Everyone will go, not go. So, you know, I think the next couple of months is going to be really tough for figuring out how to like actually get attendance, being able to hit those attendance marks where they can get as many people in the door. And there's still so many limitations out there.
Well, the Pacific Northwest and Oregon in particular are really well known for being places where people love to go out to the cinema. And, you know, I think Portland in particular has more cinema attendance, more live film attendance than just about any other place. So, you know, a lot of Hollywood productions would love to premiere here, and independent productions as well. So I don't know, we've had a year now of people getting used to streaming stuff on their home devices. What do you think? Is the gathering in theater scene going to be as healthy coming out of this as it was before?
That's the $1 trillion question. You know, all these, you know, we're seeing so much churn in terms of how people watch movies. You know, Amazon is talking to MGM about buying MGM so that their entire library is on Prime Video. And, you know, we'll see if that deal actually goes through. But as far as I'm concerned, you're not seeing a movie in its full potential unless you're seeing it in a movie theater. And obviously I'm biased because I work for the theatrical industry, but, you know, looking at someone like Disney right now, where they've got Cruella coming up, they've got some Pixar movies. Their next Pixar movie is Luca, but they're not releasing it in theaters. They're just putting it directly on Disney Plus, which to me as a consumer, just not involved in theaters, I'm thinking, well, you must not believe in it. If you're not even going to bother trying to put it in theaters, you're putting Cruella in theaters, you're putting Black Widow in theaters. Why are you not putting this in theaters? So I think we're going to see a new normal in terms of how films are actually given to customers, whether they can watch it in theaters, watch it online, do both, some combination of both. Are they going to pay $30 extra on Disney Plus to watch it? It's going to be, I think we're going to find, it's going to take probably another few months, maybe another year to find what customers are willing to go for. But I'm very confident they want to go back to the theater. You know, Black Widow by yourself, like if you're a Marvel fan, that sounds boring.
Yeah, I hear from a lot of people who are hoping that Pixar is going to change their mind on the streaming versus, you know, theatrical exhibition front.
Yeah, I you know, they've got other films down the pipeline that, you know, there's like, don't worry, it'll be in theaters. And, you know, in terms of like your bottom line, if you got a Star Wars coming out, you know, when Rogue Squadron comes out in 2 years, if you don't put that in theaters, that's $1 billion on the table that you're just saying goodbye to, that you're saying, you know, no worries, we just need subscriptions. So I think there is going to be a new, you know, level of it. But I think the good part that I'm seeing is you can just kind of get rid of the chaff that clogs theaters, because there's nothing worse than in a movie theater playing movies that don't work. And if the distributors are trying to shove bad movies towards you, you're like, why are we playing this? No one's going to go. We want the hits. So if they're reserving the very best for movie theaters, then I think that's kind of like the most symbiotic way going forward.
Well, exhibition keeps changing and production keeps changing. You know, technology has been driving a lot of changes in the film industry. Lighter equipment, for example, has allowed productions to film in more remote locations. On the other hand, digital effects have allowed a lot of studios to just stay inside and use green screens or digital rear projection effects to pretend that actors are standing on sweeping vistas. So, I mean, what's the shakeout for Oregon, for the Pacific Northwest? Are we getting more productions? Are we getting fewer productions?
We're probably in the sort of same sort of place we were, but it is changing. You're totally right. Now with virtual production, so the sort of Unreal Engine production that was used on The Mandalorian, where they create, you know, seamless LCD walls around, you know, that's here. That's being done here as well as elsewhere. And that's being explored here. It's not yet affordable, and a lot of commercials are using it, but I think there's going to be a development there of figuring out how that technology works, figuring out the front end, because there's a lot of front end work on how to program that before you actually get in and shoot something on it. And then the type of product has to be put into that. You know, a long time ago when I lived in New York, I lived through the sort of digital revolution when HD came out and the 24 frame versus the 30 frame and DigiBeta versus high def versus, you know, other digital formats. And really what came out of that is what's suitable, you know, at that point in time, what kind of film is better done in that format. And to your point, Conch, this idea of how do you embrace the tools you now have? So smaller, faster digital productions means you can probably go a little bit faster. You could shoot a lot more. You could probably work in lower light. You can digitally manipulate the image, both in color as well as VFX. And a lot of that is much more accessible to smaller productions. But then the question is, what do you do with it? Like, how do you augment your storytelling? How do you become a better filmmaker because of these tools? You can't just do it because it's cheaper, and you can't just do it because it's faster. You'll just get something that looks cheaper and faster. So all those things we think of as creative filmmakers have to be applied to the new technology. And this is what I see in AR, VR, XR, virtual production, even interactive games, and how that's crossing over with film and television. All of that is happening here in Oregon for sure, but you're going to start seeing things rise to the top in terms of the creative, the creative use of that. I have to say that Amy Dotson at the Northwest Film Center has done a great job of embracing these new technologies and showing them off. And I think just in the last year, I've seen more going on through Cinema Unbound and the work that they're doing at the Northwest Film Center than I've seen elsewhere in terms of what people are doing in these mediums and what can be done in these mediums. And it's very exciting.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned AR and VR. So augmented reality and virtual reality. And there's actually a number of studios here in town that are working in those fields, and not just for film. They're working on medical technology. They're working on all kinds of systems that people can interact with their environment or with other people that are real time, not just cinematic or television.
Yeah, so true. And that is something that is going on. A lot of the pieces to do that are being developed here, as well as the experiences themselves. I know there's a big crossover with architecture, for example, you know, building something that you can walk around before it's ever built and using XR in order to sort of do that. How that crosses over into narrative filmmaking will be really interesting. It's funny, Mac, I always go back to sort of my first visit up to the museum and the interactiveness, even though it's very basic, but, you know, the car thing where you put people in and you give them a green screen, that just that ability to see how movie magic works in the most basic sense is really sort of empowering, because now people are very aware of how all that works. And so it becomes very accessible, and it also becomes something that low budgets can embrace. And you know, I never saw an exhibit like the one at the Film Museum where you can actually sit there and do that, you know, for yourself if you want to.
Yeah, well, mention first off that the Oregon Film Museum is in an old converted jail in Astoria that was used in the Goonies. And so people can walk around not just with VR headsets on, they can touch the actual walls of the jail.
Well, and that's one of the important things that the Film Museum experience, and especially with the technology that we're talking about, more and more we need to be able to step into that. It's not just a oh, this is where it was filmed. It's this is how it was filmed. This is how this thing that you watched, or that the video game that you played, or whatever it is, that this is how it was created. And that's the people and the technology. And that's one of the key things that I think is important to keep this industry vibrant and make people aware of the industry, is that it's not just a guy with a camera, that there's all these people involved. And especially for the future creatives that are going to come into this industry, if we want to try and keep them in Oregon instead of thinking they have to go somewhere else, that maybe I'm not an actor, maybe I'm not a director, but I'm an electrician and there's jobs for me, or I'm a computer guy and there's jobs for me, and they're right here in Oregon, they pay well, they're good gigs, and you can have that creative outlet. And you know, right now the museum is small. It's in a historic 1914 jail. Two jails, two sides to the jail cells, and we've packed a lot in there, but there is so much more to this story. And I think there's a lot of different partners that can come together across the state and keep telling this story and engaging in a huge audience.
And some of the interactive things that people can do around the state, they can go down to Cottage Grove, south of Eugene, and see where Buster Keaton filmed The General. There's a mural that commemorates the filming. But you know, when you're talking about special effects, there were some amazing special effects being done in the silent era in some of these films around Oregon.
Yeah, with the Cottage Grove, the General. I mean, my understanding is they had three different cameras to record the train falling into the river, the stream there, when the bridge blows up, and they got the shot because they only had one shot at it. Then they actually left the train there until World War II, I believe it was. They realized there's a bunch of scrap metal just sitting there underneath the old bridge, and it was there. You could visit it for years and years and years.
I was just going to say the other part of that you know, Mac mentioned all those stories about the General, is the reason Buster Keaton went to Cottage Grove was because they had parallel tracks. And so early forms of VFX were that he could shoot going north in one direction and have the camera on the other track, and then just turn around and do it the opposite to shoot the thing going in the other direction. So he was able to shoot both north and south and both sides of the war right there on that little piece of track, because he had them both. I mean, yes, he wanted to escape Hollywood because he was doing a large budget movie and didn't want to be under their guys. But I think Cottage Grove provided him sort of early form VFX, and the fact that it had parallel tracks and allowed him to do very easy back and forth in terms of going in different directions.
So we've had a lockdown and a lot of indoor places have been closed, and I'm assuming the Oregon Film Museum is one of them, but the Oregon Film Trail is mostly outside and people can visit all of these sites. And how has that been? Has the lockdown inspired people to go outside and check out places where their favorite films have been produced here in the state?
I definitely have seen people posting. I mean, I definitely have seen you guys posting your little character everywhere, which is sort of wonderful during the pandemic. We've definitely gotten more signs up during the pandemic because a lot of people are seeing the other side of this, and we depend totally on local partnership in order to put the signs up. But I think in general, I see people wanting to do day trips, and definitely last summer, we saw people wanting to do day trips, and the signs provide an easy thing to do as a day trip. You know, you can go to Toledo and see where Sometimes a Great Notion was shot, or you can go to the Wallowas for a day in Joseph, you know, and see where Homeward Bound was shot. And I definitely saw an uptick on that. But I think in terms of whether you're seeing postings, because I know, Mac, you see a lot of stuff coming out of the Goonies in terms of traffic on that side of things.
You know, I don't know that anybody's really thought of a way to quantify the film trail yet, and I don't know that we'll ever be able to, but anecdotally, yes, that's definitely true. And then from the film museum standpoint, apparently I didn't get the memo, but the pandemic ended about 6 months ago or 7 months ago, because even without the cruise ships that we usually get, people are traveling, they're out there, and whether they've just gotten tired of being cooped up or whether they've got disposable income from the stimulus checks or for not having taken a big vacation a year ago, they're out there and they're traveling. And definitely with the interest that we see in film locations, I've got to believe the film trail is booming.
And Conch, just something to go on that you mentioned earlier, this idea of local premieres and local venues, something that was done amazingly before the pandemic and was closed, and I think it's going to come back, and Living Room has been part of this, is local filmmakers figuring out ways to show their films locally. You know, doing a premiere at the Living Room Theater and inviting people to come in, and they come in and they have beer and dinner, and then they go and they see the movie for the first time with a Q&A. That's done at the Liberty Theater in Astoria. It's done down in Coos Bay. It's done in Bend. It's done, you know, we are a state that has this huge amount of sort of independently run historic theaters that embrace local content. And they allow filmmakers to come in and make a special event out of it. And I think that is something the Hollywood, as we know, is sort of the forerunner of that. You know, they allow us to have a sort of localized industry that is doing their own sort of local distribution. We ran a thing for a couple of years called the Portland Circuit, where we actually had the Hollywood, the Northwest Film Center, the Clinton Street, and the and Cinema 21. So each of the four quadrants of Portland would run a new film 4 nights a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, in different theaters. Phoenix was part of this as well. But I've been to many premieres, quote unquote premieres, at the Living Room with local stuff. And I don't see that in very many other states too, this embrace of local content as an event. I kind of love that.
And I think it's a good community. The movie theaters, kind of, there's a camaraderie between all the theater owners, you know, especially given, you know, that we can have that competitive play where, you know, the four theaters can play the same film. That's not always, you know, something they can do. But, you know, as a filmmaker, I got to release my own film, and, you know, I definitely got a leg up by working at the theater where it premiered. And so that was really helpful. But I was still able to go to Bend and the Tin Pan and say, hey, do you guys want to play this? What played in Living Room, and here's what we did. You know, do you want to check it out? I got to go to Eugene. I got to go to the Bijou. I'm like, hey, I got a film for you guys. It's made in Portland. You guys should check it out. And they played it. And it's just been so nice to have that community of theaters where it's like, if it plays at one theater in one town, then it gives all the encouragement to another theater in another town over to check it out and play it. And I love that.
Ryan, let me know if this is accurate. I had heard that years ago, there's a mom and pop group of theaters here in Portland that includes the Roseway, the Cinemagic, and the Moreland, and they sort of broke the back of the big theater chain's lock on big Hollywood premieres. They kind of sued over the fact that mom and pop cinemas weren't getting the first week premieres that the big cinemas were getting.
Yeah, I wasn't totally privy to the litigation that was going on, but several years ago, you know, I know it wasn't just Oregon, but, you know, definitely theaters in Oregon were frustrated that, you know, Regal would just kind of muscle their way in and be like, no, we have exclusive rights. We're playing that. We're clearing you out is a clearance problem, and saying that theater's too close to us. You can't play it there. And we would, you know, when we were having our programming meetings, you know, it's not like we wanted to play Star Wars or Marvel movie every week. We would want to play just like a good, strong, independent film from someone like Focus Features, who's owned by Universal. So they're still playing ball as if they've got a Star Wars in their repertory. And, you know, we want to play it. And they say, you know what, it's playing in Vancouver, so, you know, that's too close. We're like, okay, let's show you a map and show you that people who live in Portland aren't going to drive up all the way to Vancouver to see it. They still want to see it here in Portland. And it's the same thing, especially in, you know, Portland itself, I've lived downtown for the longest years. Now I'm in Beaverton, and so I have to drive around. But it's like, especially in neighborhoods, if I live in a certain neighborhood and if I'm living on the west side, I'm not going to go across the river to see a theater. Like, it'll be fun to go to Hollywood to check something out. But if I'm 5 minutes away from Cinema 21, I think I should be allowed to walk to Cinema 21, not have to get on the Max, go all this way to go over to this theater. So I'm glad that we figured that problem out. And now it's a lot more fair play for theaters that want to play the same films. And now, you know, if you're downtown and a movie's playing at Cinema 21 and it's playing at Living Room Theaters and you're stuck between them, now it's up to be between Living Room Theaters being say, hey, we got the best experience, or Cinema 21 saying, hey, we got the best experience. And it's fair play because it's the same film.
Well, speaking of independent film, Tim, Oregon has a state tax incentive program. And, you know, there's actually a whole lot of states these days that have incentive programs, but Oregon's really is geared towards smaller and independent productions. It's called the Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So to your point, there's actually, I think, 32 other states that have incentive programs of some type for film and media, plus all of Canada, plus the federal side on Canada. Oregon, you know, in terms of money it returns to productions, is probably in the bottom third of what it is. To just by way of example, our quote unquote rebate is about 18% of what people spend here. And it's kind of like a Groupon. You come here, you spend money, we verify you spend that money, and we give you a little money back. So you did it. Whereas we're about 18% of spending. Someplace like California's 25%, Georgia's 30%, but they're different. They're not cash. They're this certificate that you have to sell to somebody. So not all these programs are kind of comparable, apples to apples, to everybody. We do fairly well. It's a cap system. We use all of the money we have. Right now, the OPIF program is capped at $14 million a year. We are currently in session right now in the legislature making the argument that we should increase that because we're doing well and we're seeing some more economic recovery, and we should be at the forefront of that. So we're making that argument as we speak. But it's a fairly, I would say, simple process. We're an office of four people. They deal with me and they deal with my colleague, Nathan, who does all the audits. We assess on a criteria of probably 10, 12 sort of points, like how many jobs is it going to create? Is it going to show off Oregon? Is it something new? Is it fit here? Is it a series that'll come back? Is it an interactive game? We also, I think, as everybody on this call knows, we do really well with stop motion animation. And I always say we're kind of the leader in the industry, except maybe Bristol, you know, in the UK because of Nick Park. But, you know, Leica has created an industry going back, you know, and before that, Will Vinton, an industry that we are now recognized worldwide. So we have this kind of wonderfully creatively diverse industry that is here. And yes, we do very well with locally produced stuff, from Leica all the way down to documentaries that are being done for, you know, less than five figures. And we try to support all of that ways we can, but the incentive program is something that helps any one of those. And we do have a dedicated fund just for locally produced, and we have a dedicated fund just for things that aren't being produced in Portland. And it really is pretty simple. You apply, we do a contract, you go out, you shoot your project. And at the end, you come back and you bring us all your receipts. Hopefully they're digital, but some people bring us bags and boxes of stuff. And we go through it and we verify that you spent what you said you were going to spend. And if that's correct, we have a rebate that, as I said, goes between 15 and 18%. And we write the company a check and, you know, on they go. And we get the benefit of having supported a piece of content that supports our state in some way, shape, or form. So we aren't in the top, you know, tier of incentive programs, but we actually do really well for the Northwest. We do better than Washington because theirs is smaller than ours. We definitely are in direct competition with Vancouver, but there's always 25 productions up there. And we can say, look, you'll be one of five or six if you come here and you don't have to go to Canada. You know, right now there's a quarantine. You can't get into Canada. So we've become a very good alternative place. And if we can increase it, we've had this incentive program in place now for, I think, 15 years, maybe 16 years. And it has really grown the industry, meaning people live here and work here. It's not like Louisiana, where everybody moved to Louisiana, and then when it didn't work, they all left. People are living here and working here. In fact, I think we have the opposite problem in that we have a lot of people who live here and go work elsewhere. I'm married to one right now who's working on something elsewhere. And that happens a lot. I actually would want to increase our product, our in-state production, because I want all those really qualified, wonderful people to stay in Oregon rather than go somewhere else. And that's sort of my goal in the near future.
Yeah, that actually happened to my friend who does a lot of, you know, producing work, but during the quarantine, a lot of productions couldn't get off the ground. So he had to take what he could get. And so he found some Netflix productions to work in Atlanta. But fortunately, he gets to come back next week because there's a production in town. So he can come home and work on that. And that's always, I want my friend back here. I want to hang out with him. I don't want him. He doesn't want to be out of state. He wants to be home. So
that's a heartwarming story. Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Part of the thing that I said, we had a little bit of a downturn. We were very busy during the pandemic. And then at the beginning of the year, we had a downturn. And part of that was, right to Ryan's point, is I had several sort of people that I would call our first point of contact. So line producers, production supervisors, production managers that went to Atlanta at the beginning of the year. And so when I had productions coming in, one of the first things I do is connect them to people who can actually say, here's what production is in Oregon. Here's what it costs and here's what you need to do. And a lot of those actually had gone at the beginning of the year to find other work because our work stopped in December and they went elsewhere. So it has led to a little bit of a dip. But I'm seeing it come back, to Ryan's point. I'm seeing those people come back and I'm seeing the summer start to pick up pretty well.
And unlike Atlanta, Portland has a seashore an hour and a half away and a mountain an hour and a half away.
Yes, indeed. Our locations are very much a big selling tool for us, as well as the crews that have been here just for decades.
Tim, help us understand the OPIF tax credit auction. That seems to have caused a bit of confusion with some of the local media.
It has, and thank you for bringing that up. So the way we fund the Oregon Production Investment Fund, OPIF, is through an online auction of tax credits. So people who have an Oregon tax liability can buy tax credits to offset that, and they can do that at a discount. So we auction them off at a maximum discount of 10%. So they can buy them at 90% or greater, and it's an online bidding process. You can come on and you can buy $500 increments. So you could buy one $500 increment, or you can buy 10, which would be 5,000, or 100, which would be 50,000. And you bid on those at 90% or above. And then there are winning bids. And if you have a winning bid, you pay for that and you get your credits that you can then use on your Oregon state tax returns. What we say is, it's pretty simple, is it's you're prepaying your taxes at a discount, number one. And number two, you're directing your money to an industry that not only provides employment at good paid wage jobs, but also provides content that sells Oregon to the rest of the world on a consistent basis. And we do that every autumn. So every autumn we open up an online auction where we auction off these $14 million of tax credits at the moment that we're trying to get increased. And then that's the money we utilize to fund the OPIF program. It, again, a very unique system that I don't see many other places, but it lets us have a multi-year program so that we're not tied to the two-year legislature. We actually have a 5 or 6 year program. So when I'm recruiting television series, most of them want 5 years. They want to know that they're okay for 5 years, whether they get picked up or not. But it also allows us to have a cash rebate program. So that means we're better than other states where you have to get a little certificate that you sell to somebody else through a broker and you lose money by doing that. So, you know, I think that's why we can punch a little bit above our weight class, is because we have this unique system. It's just a little convoluted in terms of online auction of tax credits. But as I said, fairly simple. Prepay your taxes at a discount, direct your money to an industry that provides jobs and creative content.
Well, Tim, Ryan, Mac, going forward, if you had your ideal version of what was going to happen next in the film industry here in Oregon, what would that look like?
I want to see a boom town. I want to see theaters filled to capacity, you know, when it can be completely safe. And I want to see productions ramp up. I want to see, you know, I have a bunch of actor friends in town. I have a bunch of producer friends in town. You know, when there's more productions, there's more stuff to do. And it's, I see a lot of friends, you know, we work on these no budget or, you know, super low budget films. But, you know, I had friends go up to Washington to work on, you know, the big Twin Peaks production. And it's like, that's a learning opportunity for them to be around big productions. So more of that happening in town, if you get to be, you know, assistant to the AD on, you know, whatever, on a big production, you get to really cut your teeth. And so I want to see more productions, theaters filled, lots of movies playing, you know, I just want to see it explode.
Mac?
I was going to say Tim next because I'm the after the fact guy.
Okay. Well, I thought you were the before the fact guy because you're historical.
For me, you know, I mean, who would have guessed 36 years ago that Goonies would attract hundreds of thousands of visitors from all over the world to make a pilgrimage to Astoria and Clatsop County. So it's not necessarily that we want a monster hit to be filmed, but we do want those quirky films that will attract cult followings that are made throughout Oregon. And for the Oregon Film Museum itself, we would love a larger facility. We're working on that. And more awareness, and that's part of what our mission is, but we want people to understand that these films are filmed all over the state, that it's a great industry, it's a green industry, that there are tons of people with great jobs that are allowed to let their creative juices flow, and you don't have to go to Hollywood to do that. You don't have to go to New York to do that. If you're an Oregonian, you can stay right here and do that. And do what you love, and people are going to like it. That would be the greatest thing.
Yeah, I'd just echo what both Ryan and Max said, meaning more potential, more work, more things coming in, but at the same time, a balanced system, meaning a system that is as much reliant on locally produced stuff as it is things coming from the outside, a system that cohabitates with itself, that creates talent coming up from below and talent teaching from above. Things that are moving around the state. So we had a really big production down in Curry and Coos counties in February that was down there for 3 weeks and spent $2.5 million locally just in around Gold Beach, right when it was necessary. Top Chef dropped into Portland, you know, right in the middle of the pandemic. It's still sort of reaping benefits in terms of showing off Portland for what it really is known for in some capacity, meaning the food scene. But it also went to the Fruit Loop and it went out to the coast and it went down to Salem. So this idea that we have an increasing opportunity in terms of jobs and content, but then also making sure the right communities are getting access to that so that we're broadening the base of people to tell their story in Oregon. And so that we can then push that out and say, hey, everybody, this is Oregon. This is what we are. And I think that's really something that we were on our way to before the pandemic, and we're coming back and seeing that opportunity come back again. But as everybody has echoed on this call, we are, you know, where there are chutes and ladders we got to go through to get there. And we're in the middle of doing that. You know, we really are. I'm just really encouraged by how strong and how vibrant and how diverse the creative community is in this state and how easy it is to show off this state on screen. So we just got to keep that train going.
Wow. So Tim, Ryan, Mac, it's been a pleasure to talk with you all today. How can our listeners find out about film production in Oregon and the organizations that you're affiliated with?
So my end, it's oregonfilm.org. That's our main site that has information on the incentives as well as past and historic productions. In addition, there's the oregonfilmtrail.com, which has all of the signs on the site. And then there's also the Oregon Confluence, which is the main blog that we use to sell stories or tell stories about what's going on in the industry here in Oregon.
You can find the Oregon Film Museum at either oregonfilmmuseum.org or at AstoriaMuseums.org. And we also post some silly stuff on Goonies Notes on Instagram.
And for my part, go see a movie at any movie theater you are closest to, but definitely come to the Living Room Theaters in downtown Portland. If you want to learn about our technology, the Preludio technology, you can just go to preludio.com and you can see the kind of films that we put up there on their service. And if you're thinking about opening a movie theater, give us a call because we are the absolute most cost-effective way to do that where you don't have to spend $100,000 on your technology. We can help you out. So open a theater with Preludio or just go to the movies, please.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. And my guests today have been Tim Williams, Executive Director of Oregon Film, Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Oregon Film Museum in Astoria, and Ryan Graves. He's a filmmaker and the Business Relationship Manager at Preludio. Thanks to all of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
You.
Thank you.
And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web, and to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And a very special thanks to Ken Jones for his expert work engineering today's program. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.